Good day. Today is Thursday, 13th November 2025, and let me begin this programme by again reminding you to tick the like button if, once you've watched this programme, or whichever part of the programme you want to listen to or watch, you've liked what you heard and you want to make known that fact. Let me now turn to the programme itself, and let me start firstly and briefly with the situation in Britain. Now, over many months now, I have been speaking about Prime Minister Starmer, his complete disconnection from the primary concerns that affect the people of Britain, his incoherent economic policy. I'm not sure that he actually has an economic policy to speak of. His increasingly fragile control over his parliamentary party, his overriding focus on foreign policy, and his obsessive focus on Ukraine, where he has, of course, been the main architect alongside his friend Emmanuel Macron of the so-called Coalition of the Willing, where he's floated extraordinary ideas of sending British troops to Ukraine under a ceasefire, after a ceasefire has been negotiated with the Russians, and provided the United States provides a backstop to protect these British troops. The Russians, of course, have categorically rejected all such ceasefire plans, made known many times that, as far as they're concerned, the presence of British troops, or indeed NATO troops, in Ukraine is completely unacceptable and a red line. And President Trump and the United States have refused to provide the much longed for and endlessly solicited backstop. But notwithstanding all of that, Prime Minister Starmer and his friend President Macron have convened meeting after meeting in London and Paris, bringing together their so-called Coalition of the Willing, talking about sending troops to Ukraine, coming up with all sorts of elaborate plans to do so, ignoring what the Russians have been saying, paying little attention to what the Americans have been saying, and basically also pushing relentlessly for what I would say were the maximalist positions that the Ukrainian government has been taking. So they've made statements about Ukraine's right to join NATO and its right to join the EU and its right to have armed forces of whatever side it wishes, and of Ukraine's need to preserve its territorial integrity. In other words, its pre-2014 borders, which incidentally include Crimea. And of course, Prime Minister Starmer, as well as meeting Zelensky many times, hugging him several times outside Downing Street, introducing Prime Minister, President Zelensky to the King, having the King take President Zelensky round Windsor Castle. Not only has Prime Minister Starmer been doing all of that, made open and obvious for everyone to see his devotion to the Ukrainian cause, to the point where he has become Prime President Zelensky's leading advocate in Washington. But a few months ago, he concluded a treaty with President Zelensky in which, amongst other things, he said that Ukraine was on an irreversible path towards NATO, something which, of course, Russia considers totally and completely unacceptable. Even as all that has been going on, the British economy has been at best stagnating, in fact, actually declining. Last month, it actually contracted. Living standards have been falling, inflation has been sticky, and the budget deficit has ballooned, even as Britain continues to provide funding, large amounts of funding, to Ukraine. And, well, there are all sorts of other issues and complaints that can be made about Prime Minister Starmer. But as I said, his single-minded focus on Ukraine, I think, will one day come to be seen as the single most important cause that lies behind many of those other problems. And along the way, Labour Party's popularity has declined as it's failed to gain a grip on economic problems, on the migration issue, enormously important as that is for many people in Britain, as the budget crisis continues to worsen. And, well, the day before yesterday, finally, it all came to a head. Just a few days before, the British Finance Minister, Rachel Reeves, made a statement in which she clearly signalled the government's decision to break one of its key promises ahead of the 2024 election, which was not to increase the general rate of income tax in Britain. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, and his team are clearly extremely nervous of the public reaction once that happens. They've been obviously very worried, very frightened that Keir Starmer's increasing numbers of critics within the British Labour Party would, at that point, mount a leadership challenge, or to be more precise, a demand that Starmer and presumably Reeves step down. And as many people do when they find themselves in this sort of situation, Starmer and his team decided to preempt that challenge by coming out publicly and saying that a challenge like that was likely underway, dropping heavy hints that the main plotter, the person behind the challenge, was the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, and saying that Prime Minister Starmer, if there was a challenge of that kind, would fight for his job, and that if the challenge did take place, there would be enormous political instability, the bond markets would be upset, and perhaps most bizarre of all, at least to me, the President Trump, who apparently nowadays supposedly thinks of Keir Starmer as his friend, that Donald Trump, of all people, would be unhappy. Well, in many areas of life, and I've seen this myself done many times, people who sense that criticism or a challenge is coming think that it's a clever thing to preempt it, to try to preempt it, by anticipating what the critics or the challengers will say. And they think that it's a clever thing to come out and talk about it before it happens and to answer the criticisms before they're made. And it has been my almost invariable experience, and as a lawyer, Keir Starmer of all people should know this, it has been my almost invariable experience that doing something like that backfires. It merely publicises criticisms that up to that point had not been made, and it makes the possibility of a challenge even more likely, as that possibility from that moment onward becomes a talking point. And I think that Starmer's decision, and I have no doubt, despite his attempts to distance himself from what happened, Starmer's decision to try to preempt the challenge that he must have known would come has predictably backfired. The people who we were led to believe, clearly led to believe, were the likely plotters, Wes Streeting first and foremost, have now been given the perfect opportunity to come out and say that they were not plotting at all, that all of these claims that they were plotting, calumnies, that Keir Starmer is no longer in charge of his own team, that the entire team must therefore be sacked, leaving Prime Minister Starmer in an even worse political position than the one he is in already. And, well, the result is that we now have a governmental crisis in Britain alongside a budgetary crisis, with the government's almost certainly deeply unpopular budget looming just over the horizon. Now, I don't know how long this will go on for, but my guess is not very. And the unanimous opinion across the British media, including even the Labour Party supporting media, which incredibly still exists in Britain, is that Starmer has just holed himself under the waterline and is sinking, and that there is nothing now that can be done to retrieve the situation. So it is no longer a case of if, but when, and when might not be very long, because the longer this continues, the more uncertainty and chaos in government there is going to be, and that will inevitably bring forward the day when people come along to Starmer and tell him this can't go on, it must end, and the only way it can end is for you to step down and go. So we are probably, hopefully, in the last weeks of the premiership of Keir Starmer. And I am not going to make any attempt to conceal my views here. As far as I'm concerned, it'll be good riddance. I think he has been a terrible Prime Minister in every conceivable respect. I think he's done everything wrong from the moment that he was elected. I expected that he would do things wrong. I was never a fan, as people who followed us on the Duran know. But even I did not expect that it would turn out quite as bad as it did. Anyway, I will not be sorry to see Keir Starmer go. On the contrary, I will be relieved and pleased. The problem is, looking at the situation in Britain today, none of the people who might replace him, certainly not Wes Streeting, certainly not Ed Miliband, the person who's in charge of climate policy, certainly not the former Labour deputy leader Angela Rayner, who's also said to be manoeuvring, certainly not the mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham. None of these people seem to me to have the political authority, or indeed the imagination and the understanding of the situation which is needed to turn things round. And when I say turn things round, I don't mean for the British Labour Party, which, as far as I'm concerned, ought to be the least of everybody's concerns. But for Britain itself, for the people who live there, for the country that they are supposed to govern. Anyway, Starmer, perhaps not gone yet. It may take a few weeks. He might cling on to Christmas or the New Year, but soon enough, I predict he will be gone. Another victim of the Alensky curse. It's something he embraced repeatedly by hugging Zelensky in the way that he did outside Downing Street. I thought that was an extraordinary and bizarre thing to do when he did it the first time, but he went on doing it repeatedly ever after. But once he's gone, don't expect anybody to learn any lessons. The Zelensky curse will still be there, stalking political leaders and prime ministers in Britain, because they will all fall over each other to embrace it. At least that is what I predict. Anyway, maybe not the most important event in the world, but Britain is, after all, my country. The fall of a prime minister, though hardly the great event that it once was, is nonetheless an event of some significance. I can't avoid but discuss it. So let's turn to the far more important, far greater events which are playing out, and they continue to play out mostly in Ukraine. And I'm going to again do as I have been doing in recent programmes by starting with a brief rundown of the military situation. And there have been some important military developments overall, specifically in the two areas that we've been talking about quite a lot recently, the Pokrovsk conurbation and Kupiansk, but also now increasingly in Zaporozhye too. Now, in terms of Pokrovsk, I think that perhaps the moment has come to stop talking about the encirclement of the Ukrainian grouping in Pokrovsk, because from what I can see, Pokrovsk is essentially under Russian control. The Ukrainian forces there have almost entirely abandoned the town. There may be still some stragglers hiding in various places in the town. There are apparently pockets of resistance still in the northeast and west of Pokrovsk, or at least there were yesterday. The Russian Defense Ministry spoke of clearing them. I think this is an operation that will be completed very fast. As of the time of making this video, it might already have been completed. I read an account on the Russian Defense Ministry's website given by a former Ukrainian soldier who was in Pokrovsk and who has surrendered. I don't like to talk and repeat about what prisoners of war have said. I find the whole topic, the whole idea of interviewing prisoners of war, extremely disturbing, and I would much rather that it were not done at all. But in this case, I'm going to make an exception, because this prisoner of war spoke about how he and the small group of Ukrainian soldiers who he was with were basically isolated in a single building in Pokrovsk. They'd lost all touch, all contact with the Ukrainian command. They were basically, they were entirely on their own. And by his account, when the Russians showed up after some desultory fighting, the entire group, and he doesn't say how many of them there were, just laid down their arms and surrendered. Now, that might be untypical. There might be other Ukrainian soldiers who put up more of a fight. Probably there are, but that was an account given by one soldier. And for once, it rings true. So Pokrovsk itself, it seems to me now, is a done thing. To the extent that there is fighting going on within the Pokrovsk cauldron, it is entirely within Mirnograd. That is where the Ukrainian troops have retreated to. That is where organized resistance still takes place. But the Russians are closing in. And the recent mapping projects have provided information about Russian advances in southern and eastern Mirnograd, and also in northern Mirnograd too. The Ukrainians still nominally control a significant stretch of this town. Some say up to three quarters of it. I'm going to guess that it's really much less than that, more like 40% of it. I say that because I doubt that these maps that we see actually reflect the reality closely anymore. But the fact is that the Russians are closing in. The Russian Defense Ministry said this morning that Rogh, one of the two villages that the Russians have been capturing in the eastern suburbs of Pokrovsk itself, that Rogh is being mopped up. I expect that we will learn that Rogh has passed entirely under Russian control, probably by tomorrow. And there's also reports that the Russians are now in full control of all the road and railway links that previously connected Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. And perhaps it's worth saying that really these two places form a continuous urban centre. Mirnograd, as far as I'm concerned, was always essentially a relatively new industrial and residential suburb of Pokrovsk itself. So the Ukrainians are still there. It is universally acknowledged now, except of course by Zelensky and Syrsky and people like that, that the ring around these Ukrainian troops is tightening. There is no possibility now of retreat. And with the Russians pushing the Ukrainians as they advance into Mirnograd from the east, these Ukrainian troops, who must be increasingly short of supplies, have nowhere that they can retreat to. There's already been, as I discussed in a recent program, isolated cases of surrender. I suspect before long, the whole group will break, and we'll probably see the first mass surrenders in this area. Perhaps not quite on the scale of what we saw in Mariupol back in 2022, when 2,000 Ukrainian troops, mostly from the Azov Brigade, surrendered en masse, but something not that different. Anyway, that's clearly the direction of travel there. Now, there have been many claims, many reports from the Ukrainians that they've been fighting to capture Rodinska to the north of Pokrovsk as part of an operation to break through, to break the Russian ring around Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, to allow the Ukrainian troops there either to be reinforced or to escape. And I spoke, I think it was yesterday, about video footage that the Ukrainians released of a Ukrainian tank operating in the central area of Rodinska. And I also pointed out that various mapping and reporting channels had established, through all kinds of absolutely secure means, that this footage was actually taken in the first week of October. It is not contemporaneous at all. I've expressed my own belief that Rodinska is firmly under Russian control. That certainly seems to be what Radovka, the Russian newspaper in Smolensk, believes. And, well, footage has now appeared of the Ukrainians launching attacks on Russian soldiers at the western end of the central part of Rodinska, precisely the territory which the Ukrainians claim to have captured. I have no doubt at all that Rodinska is entirely under Russian control. And I've also said that it looks to me as if the Russians are now close to encircling the city of Sharkovo, the village of Sharkovo, slightly to the east, northeast. And again, this is the same area where the Ukrainians have been claiming that they've been conducting successful counterattacks. Again, the mapping projects have published changes to their maps now, and it does look as if Sharkovo itself has been mostly surrounded, in fact, almost completely surrounded by the Russians. And my guess is that it too will fall, probably quite quickly at some point over the next few weeks. So the Pokrovsk-Kupiansk battle is perhaps got a few days to go. I suspect that from any day now, the Russian Defense Ministry will confirm that Pokrovsk is fully under Russian control. The fate of the Ukrainian grouping in Mirnograd still has to be decided, but there's no real doubt anymore, or so it seems to me, about what its eventual fate will be. Captivity, if these soldiers and whoever commands them are wise, a much more grisly fate if they are not. But there is no rescue for these people. And I think the same is true of Kupiansk. The Russians have been providing more information about Kupiansk over the last few hours. They say that the encirclement of Kupiansk is tightening, or at least the encirclement of the Ukrainian group near Kupiansk is tightening. The Russians have confirmed, interestingly, that the territory that they have captured is, that they've just captured, eastern Kupiansk, as they say, is indeed located on the east bank of the Oskol River, and that essentially the battle there is over. The whole of the industrial sector of eastern Kupiansk is now fully under Russian control. All that leaves now is some empty fields east of Kupiansk itself, where there are still Ukrainian troops apparently out in the open and basically surrounded. Yevgeny Lisniak, deputy head of the Russian-backed Kharkov Military Civilian Administration for Defense, has made some comments. He's told TASS that Kupiansk remains the epicenter of the fiercest fighting. The situation for the Ukrainian military there is critical. The western part of the city, the right bank of the Oskol, is the scene of street fighting, and that is where, as I said, the Russians appear to be pushing south. And he goes on to say there are reports of control of several streets in the southern and western parts of the city. And then he went on to say that on the left bank of the Oskol, Ukrainian units had been almost completely mopped up. So the major cauldron located to the east has been reduced, and the Russians believe, or appear to believe, that the battle there is all but over. So anyway, that is Lisniak. There's comments by other Russians. Vitaly Ganchev, who is senior to Lisniak, he says, he's again talking about Kupiansk, in the future, the encirclement will close in and narrow. We see it expanding on our side every day, and accordingly it is narrowing inside, and this group is becoming smaller and smaller. They have nowhere to go because our encirclement is closing in from the south. The Ukrainian troops remaining in the encirclement will either surrender or be destroyed. There is no other option and no help coming. Anyway, that's what he said. And he also said, Ganchev also said, that in Volchansk, the Russians are also completing an encirclement of a small group of Ukrainian troops who continue to hold out. I believe at the very eastern end of the town, the vast bulk of that town is now fully under Russian control. So that's Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Kupiansk, Volchansk. Even more dramatic news has been coming from Zaporozhye. And here we're starting to see what can only be described as a collapse of Ukrainian resistance. And the Ukrainians have now woken up to the crisis that they're facing in Zaporozhye region. There's been a huge amount of anger and recrimination on the part of Ukrainian commentators about the collapse in Zaporozhye. Again, the best place to read about all of that and to read examples of what Ukrainian commentators have been saying about the crisis in Zaporozhye is in the Events in Ukraine Substack blog. Suffice to say that the Russians have now captured two more important villages just to the northeast of Gulyapolye. Extraordinarily, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry itself, before the Russians had even confirmed the capture of these places, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry announced that the Ukrainian troops had abandoned these two villages and had retreated from them to take up more defendable positions. A tactical withdrawal, if you prefer. Anyway, these two places have now been captured. The only defendable positions which I can see nearby are the town of Gulyapolye itself, which is just 8 kilometers away, just saying. And there is nothing now between these forward Russian positions in these two villages and the town of Gulyapolye itself. If the Russians were minded to launch an attack on Gulyapolye from the northeast, the way is open for them to do so. All that lies between the Russians and Gulyapolye now is open country. I don't think the Russians are going to do that. I think they're going to first cut the road, the supply roads leading to Gulyapolye. They have, as of today, cut the important road, supply road, that leads to Gulyapolye from the north. And this is apparently much the more important of these two roads. A few minutes ago, just before I started making this program, the Russian Defense Ministry confirmed that a village called Danilovka, which is actually located in Dnipropetrovsk region, has just been captured by the Russian army. This village lies directly upon this main road. The main road passes through it. So capturing this village means that the Russians have cut the road, which means that the Ukrainian garrison in Gulyapolye can no longer receive supplies along this road from the north. There is another road that the Ukrainians can use to supply their garrison in Gulyapolye. It is a road which leads to Gulyapolye from the west, I believe from the town of Orekhov. But one can immediately see problems with using this road, which is that the Russian military already have positions and have long had positions immediately to the south of this road. For the record, I suspect that this road is already well inside the range of the Russian drones. So it looks as if the supply roads to Gulyapolye have already in effect been cut. But I still believe that before they launch a frontal assault on Gulyapolye, the Russians will want to consolidate and they will want to move beyond this road, strung out on the western side of this road are a group of villages. They apparently are located on high ground, and it would be difficult to move beyond, to attack these villages head on, directly from the east. So they do form a defensive barrier. But Danilovka is located to the north of these villages and of this area of high ground, which makes it possible for the Russians to advance south along the road from Danilovka, outflank the Ukrainian defences in these villages and potentially encircle them, putting the Russians in a position where they can take the whole of Gulyapolye into a cauldron. Unless, of course, Zelensky and Syrsky break with their invariable practice and try to pull the Ukrainians out, the Ukrainian troops there out. Something which, by the way, I don't believe they're going to do. The catastrophe, and there is no better word, that the Ukrainians have experienced in Zaporozhye region is extraordinary. I too have never seen an advance by the Russians which has been so fast. There have been many criticisms in the Ukrainian media of the Ukrainian commander in this area, who is none other than General Tarnavsky. I remember General Tarnavsky very well because he was the general who was the operational commander of Ukraine's disastrous and comprehensively defeated summer 2023 offensive, the one which was supposed to break through the Surovikin line and which was supposed to reach the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. It's extraordinary to me that General Tarnavsky, whose record has been one of consistent failure in every command that he has held, continues to be there still commanding troops. So I can absolutely believe that much of the blame for this disaster in Zaporozhye does indeed lie with him. But like was pointed out on a program we did with him by Scott of Calibrated earlier this week, ultimately the fundamental problem the Ukrainians have is that there are many more Russians now on the battlefronts than there are Ukrainians, that this is true right across the entire conflict line. The Ukrainians no longer have enough men or machines to hold back the Russians on any part of the front line for very long. And as Larry Johnson has pointed out on Sonar 21, his absolutely indispensable blog, probably, in fact, unquestionably, what slowed down the Russians in 2024 when they went onto the offensive after they defeated Ukraine's 2023 counteroffensive, was that they did not, at that time, outnumber the Ukrainians by any very substantial margin, But now they do. They're far better organised than they used to be. They've perfected modern combined arms tactics, just say. They have established drone and air dominance, both over the battlefields and over the rear, Ukraine's rear areas. And the Russians also have massive superiority in equipment, tanks, armoured vehicles, guns, shells, all of those things. And even an outstanding general, and nobody is claiming that General Tarnovsky is an outstanding general, at least nobody that I have seen, nobody, not even an outstanding general, now has the ability, it seems to me, to correct the situation, given this imbalance. Now, there are lots of things also taking place in other parts of the battlefronts. Further north in Dniepropetrovsk, the Russians appear to, Dniepropetrovsk region, the Russians appear to be preparing to attack a big village called Velikomikhailovka. Further north still, the careful process of encircling the fortified town of Novopavlivka is also underway. The Russians have apparently increased the tempo of their advance in Konstantinovka. And we've not heard much about the fighting in Liman and Siversk. My guess is that the Russians are consolidating their existing gains and are regrouping their forces there, and that over the next couple of days we will learn of another big Russian advance along in the territory of these two towns also. But everywhere, in every part of the front lines, the situation for Ukraine gets ever more critical. And really, there is no solution for it. There is nothing that the Western powers can do to redress the situation. And increasingly, I get the sense, not of so much of a fatalism, but of an awareness that Pokrovsk soon, at least, is going to fall. And a quiet panic already starting to grow. And I expect that when Pokrovsk does fall, and perhaps when other places, Gulyapolya perhaps, Konstantinovka, Siversk, Kupiansk, who knows which, other places start to fall as well, then we're going to see this panic burst out into the open. There continue to be some brave voices in the media in the West who still want to insist that all is well. I read an article earlier today in The Economist which continues to insist that the Ukrainians are holding their positions and that Vladimir Putin has no path to victory. Before long, these comforting illusions are going to shatter. And when that happens, the panic, the big panic we saw after the fall of Avdiivka in February 2024 is going to be eclipsed multiple fold by the panic which is to come. And we will see what, if anything, Western governments do when that moment reaches them. But for the moment at least, as of now, they're doing nothing. They're behaving, as I've said many times in many programmes, they're behaving like rabbits on the road caught in the headlights of the oncoming car. Anyway, that's the situation on the battlefronts. Now, in Kiev itself, the political crisis that I touched on yesterday is intensifying. And it continues to be a crisis driven by corruption investigations launched by NABU and SAPO. NABU seems to be the main agency against members of Zelensky's inner circle. And I'm not going to go through all of the details. Suffice to say that we've already had, before the latest wave of arrests began, we've already had little tidbits of information telling us about where things were going, starting to appear in the media in the West. So about 2 weeks ago, I remember, an article appeared, I think it was in the New York Times, about how little companies in the United States had received vast contracts to build huge fleets of drones for Ukraine, things that they had no ability or capacity to do, and which had no real connections to their existing rather small businesses. We had similar reports, well, mirror reports, about some of the companies in Ukraine that had already also received these contracts. We're now getting reports about the Flamingo cruise missile that Zelensky has been talking so much about, this huge V1, German V1 lookalike that the Ukrainians have displayed, which appeared to be based upon a cruise missile designed in the UAE by a British company. And there was lots of talk about it entering into serial production, and some reports that up to 9 of these missiles had actually been launched under against Russian positions. I speculated that this was the missile which might have been used to attack the chemical factory in Bryansk, about which, by the way, after the Ukrainian Defense Ministry made all sorts of claims, I have seen nothing. I've seen nothing further about that alleged attack. Anyway, it's now starting to look as if the entire Flamingo missile affair was basically a fake. It was another exercise in smoke and mirrors. There were all kinds of contracts and plans to develop this missile and mock-ups of it cobbled together, but never really real plan to build it. No factories assigned to do so, or none of that kind of thing. It was all, it looks like, and you know, maybe I'm jumping too far ahead, but it's starting to look like it was all really a money-making exercise for some people. Anyway, we've had lots of this, lots of stories of suitcases with cash being found, pictures of golden toilet seats, an extraordinary picture. And again, I will express my own bafflement here as to why exactly anybody would want a golden toilet seat. It seems a very strange thing to do, even if you have lots of gold and to spare. There are other uses, presumably, you could put to it. But anyway, there's pictures of that and reports of more and more people close to Zelensky himself at risk of arrest. And Zelensky has somewhat unconvincingly spoken of his support for the investigations and people who are implicated in the scandal have fled abroad. The ringleader, or at least the named ringleader, has allegedly escaped to Israel, which of course doesn't do extraditions. Zelensky has sanctioned this person, though some people are saying that the sanctions are full of holes. This individual, by the way, I ought to say, seems to have been very close to Zelensky himself, and some people supposedly referred to this man as Zelensky's wallet. I'm not going to get into speculations about the extent to which that is true. And it is also said that this same individual was the contact person who originally brought Zelensky together with his former erstwhile patron, the oligarch Igor Kolomoisky, who, by the way, in Ukraine, is also currently in prison. So anyway, a major scandal is underway and the Ukrainian media are talking all about this. They're talking about how money that was allocated to building defense lines was embezzled, about the fact that protection for energy, for the energy system was embezzled as well, and all of those things. And since I'm talking about the energy system, I've seen a video of Kiev last night, and I don't know how permanent these blackouts are in Kiev, but at the time this video was made, or is claimed to have been made, Kiev was again in darkness, and all you could see were the headlights of the cars. It seems as if all of the electricity was turned off. And Ukraine's major electricity provider has now said that the town of Poltava, which is located east of the Dnieper River, has now been completely disconnected from the electricity system, that it's impossible to continue to supply electricity through the to Poltava through the electricity system because of the immense damage that has been done. The major Russian, the last big Russian missiles and drone strike on Ukraine's electricity system, which is extremely devastating, took place last week. Repairs have been done. Some electricity has been restored, but the fact that we're still getting these blackouts and that they can't restore Poltava to the overall system tells us about how bad the damage is. And, well, in the midst of all of that, we have all of the claims about the corruption and about how steps intended to strengthen and harden the electricity system from Russian attacks were not taken because the money was embezzled. And, well, some of these stories have now spread to the media in the West, and there is an article in The Spectator, again by Owen Matthews, talking about the corruption scandal and saying that this could put Zelensky's own position in doubt, in jeopardy. Now, all of this is very, very interesting. There are a number of issues with this story. First of all, the total amounts that we are seeing mentioned as part of this embezzlement and corruption that has been detected as a result of these investigations, the total amounts come to some $100 million, which may sound like an awful lot of money. And of course, to all of us who have watched these programs, it is an awful lot of money. But it is very, very small change indeed, relative to the huge sums that have been flowing into Ukraine from the West, basically since the start of the Ukraine crisis with the Maidan coup back in February 2014. Ukraine has been in receipt not of tens, but of hundreds of billions of dollars of financial and economic support from the West since then. And that does not, of course, also include military support as well. It's budget situation, by the way, despite all of this enormous money that has flowed into Ukraine, continues to deteriorate. I read that the uncovered deficit of the Ukrainian state budget reaches $60 billion for the 2026-2027 period, for the next budgetary period. And this was said to Ukrinform news agency by Deputy Finance Minister of Ukraine, Alexander Kava. Concerning the year of 2026 with the Ministry of Finance in respect of planning of state budget expenditures for next year, this budget will be more difficult for us than the year 2025. When we prepared the draft budget for this year, we had clear understanding for the state budget deficit. And now he says, as I said, that the budget deficit is exploding, $60 billion. Well, that might not be so much for some countries in the West. In the United States, it would be a rounding up error. But I believe that it is well over half of the income that the Ukrainian state receives from domestic taxation. And the European Commission is apparently now saying that lending to Ukraine is becoming difficult because the country's credit worthiness is collapsing. It should have collapsed years ago. I mean, as I've said many times, Ukraine defaulted on its key loans back in 2015 and has been, properly speaking, bankrupt ever since. And its situation has been deteriorating steadily since then, up to 2022, when the deterioration has not been steady, but, well, vertiginous. I mean, it's been a vertiginous collapse. It's incredible that people have continued to lend money or roll over debt with Ukraine during that period. And that the IMF in particular has continued with its lending programme. But anyway, the European Commission has admitted that this is the situation. It's also said that assigned funds out of the European budget, the European Union budget to support Ukraine, have all been used up. The European Union has no further money to provide to Ukraine. Donald Trump has publicly, at least, stopped direct transfers of funds to Ukraine. And I think that even he realises that resuming direct funding of Ukraine from the US budget would be too much for his already very angry and restless electoral base. So I don't think there will be much more money coming from that source. And, well, for the moment, the plan to cobble together a loan using the stolen, frozen Russian assets as collateral is stalled because of the strong opposition of Belgium, Hungary and Slovakia, and the quiet opposition behind the scenes of Italy and France. So, altogether, vast sums of money have gone to Ukraine. Titanic sums of money have gone to Ukraine. They have at no point transformed Ukraine. You don't see much evidence of vast building programs, new dams being created, vast, shining, modernized airports, any of that. Ukraine's infrastructures, that I've seen at any rate, in the various videos that I've seen, and I've seen pretty much all of the videos, as far as I know, that are produced from Ukraine since the war. Anyway, most of the infrastructure still seems to date from the Soviet era. I've seen very little sign outside Kiev itself, and perhaps to a lesser extent, Lvov, very little sign that this huge tidal wave of money that has poured into Ukraine since 2014 has left very much of substance behind it. There isn't even, apparently, a sovereign wealth fund on which, from which Ukraine can take money. And we see that now they're running this monstrous budget deficit, which on their own domestic earnings, they can't cover. So, given that this is so, $100 million here and there, what is that? It is nothing. And that does make one wonder about whether this is really an anti-corruption investigation at all, or perhaps rather an exercise in political reckoning, that this is all part of some attempt to wage some kind of political conflict, some use of the anti-corruption agencies, NABU and SOPA, to try to undermine Zelensky's position, with Zelensky himself pushing back in whatever way he can. I mentioned that article in The Spectator by Owen Matthews. It contains this important sentence: one sad takeaway of this murky story is that in many ways Ukraine continues to live by the same rules as prevailed in the wild 1990s under former Ukrainian president Leonid Kuchma, who is still, by the way, a major player in Ukrainian politics, or in Boris Yeltsin's Russia. In the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, it became commonplace for wealthy businessmen to buy control over elements of the security forces and put them to work recording private conversations between leading politicians or business rivals and use the resulting kompromat as a political tool. This time round, the players are the Western-backed NABU duking it out with the Zelensky-backed SBU. But the crossover of corruption and high-level politics feels depressingly like a trip back to the future. I'm going to say straight away that the reality, as far as I'm concerned, is that Ukraine never exited the 1990s. Russia did, but Ukraine did not. And that, perhaps, lies at the heart of Ukraine's great tragedy. But I'm not going to discuss this further in this programme. He does say, this is another point that Owen Matthews makes, the image of a golden toilet, which was discovered in former President Yanukovych's luxurious suburban mansion, became an iconic emblem of the corruption that led to the 2014's momentous Maidan protests. It's a supreme irony that the revolution against those golden toilet owners led eventually to a full-scale war with Russia, the profits from which, it seems, have been used to buy yet more golden toilets. Well, I have nothing to add to that. Now, I don't understand, and I'm not going to waste time trying to understand, the political backstory to this corruption conflict that is taking place in Kiev. What I will say about it, however, is this. Firstly, in spite of everything, I still don't believe that Zelensky's own position is seriously under threat, even if he is as deeply implicated in the corruption as rumours, well-informed rumours, all say. The reason is that Zelensky remains the only figure in the Ukrainian government who, because he was elected all those years ago, retains some figment of legitimacy. Remove him from the scene and there is no legitimacy of any kind left. You would get a provisional government of some kind, and that would have no democratic, or, by the way, constitutional standing in Ukraine. And I can't help but think that in a crisis like the one that Ukraine is going through at the moment, that is a recipe for political collapse and state disintegration, which I would have thought that all the players, including Western governments, would want to avoid. The alternative would be a coup by the military, which would quickly evolve into a coup by the ultra-nationalist brigades. But that would shatter the entire narrative in the West that this is a plucky democracy fighting the autocrats of Moscow. And I don't think that people in the West will want to see that. Secondly, I think that far too many people in the West are too deeply involved with Zelensky himself. I spoke about Keir Starmer hugging Zelensky outside Downing Street. Well, others might not have gone quite that far, but just go back on X and try to track all of those comments that were made by Western officials and Western political leaders, European political leaders, the prime ministers and presidents, and NATO secretary generals and EU commission presidents and commissioners and all of those people. Just go back and read all of those. Read what General Kellogg and people like him have been writing about Zelensky. They're already going to be seriously embarrassed when the elaborate narrative that Zelensky has concocted, that he has the whole situation on the front lines completely under control, collapses as it's going to within the next few weeks. How are they going to come back and tell people in France, Germany, Britain, the United States, many of these countries, people who are undergoing real economic hardship, that we've been sending tens of billions of pounds and euros and dollars, and by the way, also Swiss francs, to support President Zelensky, who instead of being this heroic figure, this Churchill holding back the Russians, was a sleazy, corrupt figure all along, who has had, as a result and in consequence, to be removed from power. I think even for the narrative spin masters that we have in the West, it's about the one thing we're good at is spinning narratives. I think this is a challenge too far. So for all of these reasons, I think Zelensky himself is safe. So that's one thing I am going to say about this. Probably we will get a rearrangement of the political system in Ukraine. All sorts of people who were important will cease to be so. Perhaps other members of the pre-Zelensky old guard, people like Poroshenko and Klitschko and Yulia Tymoshenko and people of that kind will reemerge. Just saying. But Zelensky himself, I suspect, is still going to be there. Secondly, whatever comes, it's not going to change the policy. I've already said that, in my opinion, the political system in Kiev utterly precludes anybody gaining power who would want to seek some kind of settlement with the Russians. In fact, all that would happen is that you would shoo away one bunch of flies feeding on the bleeding corpse, which is now Ukraine. You'd simply replace that bunch of flies with a new bunch of flies, and they would want to keep things going just a few months longer so they can satiate themselves during that period. So that's the second thing I am going to say about this. And, well, in the end, it's not going to change Western policy either. Logically, with all of this going on, the Europeans should be stopping all further talk now of Ukraine joining the European Union. They should be ceasing all discussions about sending more money or more weapons to Ukraine, given the proof of corruption that there already is. But of course, they're going to do the opposite. Germany, which is also now starting to move inexorably towards a budget crisis, it has just increased its direct funding of Ukraine from 9 billion euros a year to 11 billion euros a year, even as all of these corruption revelations come to the fore. Germany is stepping up, giving even more. Some people in Kiev, one would like to believe, must be very appreciative and very grateful that the government in Berlin is looking after them so well. Just saying. Anyway, so don't expect anything to change from all of this. But my very last point is that this rearrangement in Kiev, this new set of flies replacing the old set of flies, is a further sign of ongoing defeat and collapse. As people in Kiev understand that the days are ending, the need to fill up the suitcases in preparation for the dash out is going to intensify, and that inevitably means that people who are already there, close to the source of the funds, have to be pushed aside to make way for those who still need to fill up their suitcases. I am sorry if this is all sounds like a very, very cynical take about what is going on. No doubt there are some people who will, in the West, believe in all of this. They will say, well, you know, there are some bad and corrupt people in Ukraine, but here's the proof that Ukraine, Kiev, really is the shining city on the hill, because we see anti-corruption investigations actually taking place and malefactors brought to account. Well, you can believe that if you choose, but if you do, I have a bridge to sell you. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about this. Now, the Financial Times, consistent with the way in which the British media is now starting to prepare the British public for the military crisis in Ukraine, the Financial Times has now also published a long article about conceding something that in these programs I've been saying for quite a while now, that the Russians have now achieved dominance in the sky, and that they are moving forward, and that it's Russian drones that now dominate the skies over Ukraine. And the title of the article is "The Elite Russian Unit Hunting Ukraine's Drone Warriors. Moscow's New Rubicon Team Upends Kiev's Control of the Electronic Battlefield." And it is a long article about the Rubicon Group. An interesting article in some respects. It gives the number of people involved, which it claims is 5,000. I actually believe it is much more than that. And incidentally, yesterday, the Russian Defense Ministry announced the setting up of a new branch of service within the Russian military, which is the branch of the service which deals with drone warfare and remote weapons and that kind of thing. Anyway, the Financial Times article is mostly about the Rubicon Group, but it does make along the way a number of very interesting points. It concedes something which I suspect will be a shock for some British readers, that the Russians do in fact now have a decisive superiority in drone warfare over Ukraine, and that the Rubicon Group is far and away the best organised and most effective drone unit operating on either side in the Ukraine war. So that is one major revelation. The second touches on something that was discussed by Scott of Calibrated in the programme that we did with him on Monday. And Scott, over the course of that programme, mentioned that over the course of the last couple of months, the Russians have been conducting a systematic policy of killing Ukrainian drone operators, with the Rubicon Group at the forefront of this. Part of what the Rubicon Group does, probably a department of it, is intended to track down, search out and kill Ukrainian drone operators. And the Russians have been extraordinarily successful in this. And this means that Ukraine is not only short of drones, which, by the way, it is. There have been denials about this, but it is, in fact, increasingly short of drones. And I've discussed in many programmes how, unlike the Russian industrial production of drones, which means that the Russians have consistent and clear categories of drones which have uniform characteristics, Ukraine's drones produced by small workshops across Ukraine constitute a barely manageable, perhaps entirely unmanageable, zoo. Anyway, apart from the fact that the Russians now have many more drones, the Ukrainians now are suffering from a catastrophic shortage of drone operators. And that this means that Ukraine cannot operate drones. And it points out, the article points out, that it takes a very long time to train up a drone operator to the level of skill which is needed. And the third thing the Financial Times article points out is something that I've been saying actually for a very long time, which is that the Russians use drones differently from the way that the Ukrainians do. The Ukrainians use drones to repel Russian attacks on the actual battle lines. Ukrainian drones target mostly Russian tank or infantry units as they go into battle. Whereas the Russians, by contrast, use their drones to disrupt Ukraine's logistics. Their primary target are Ukraine's rear areas. They use the drones to cut off the supply roads, to choke the Ukrainians of supplies on the battlefronts. And this is consistent with long-standing Russian doctrine. I remember they did exactly the same in Syria after 2014, when they bombed the jihadi supply roads to the battlefronts rather than the jihadi troops at the front lines themselves. And it is incredibly effective. It means that Ukrainian troops on the front lines are choked of supply. And you could see this in place after place, roads and crossroads especially on Ukraine, littered with the carcasses of burnt out Ukrainian supply vehicles and empty roads stretching for huge distances across Ukraine behind the front lines as the Russians seek to attack them. Anyway, it is an interesting article, as it doesn't tell me anything that I hadn't heard before, but it will certainly be something that will come as a surprise, even as a shock, perhaps, to some British readers. Well, there it is. The war goes on. The economic crisis in Ukraine deepens. We see the political crisis as well. Over the next few weeks, I suspect we're going to start to get more and more dramatic news. The big unanswered question, to which I'm not going to give any confident answers, is what the West in this situation is going to do. As to that, we shall have to wait and see. Meanwhile, the President of the United States is, it seems to me, once again bogged down in a familiar scandal. More and more bits of information, emails and such, are now starting to appear, written by and from the, well, let's call him financier, Jeffrey Epstein, about whose reputation everybody who watches this program is no doubt fully informed. I'm going to say a number of things about these emails. Firstly, one shouldn't be in too much of a rush to assume that because Jeffrey Epstein said something in an email, it is necessarily true. So I read, for example, that Jeffrey Epstein spoke about how Donald Trump spent the better part of a day with an unnamed individual. There's a lot of speculation as to who that individual was, but we read elsewhere that this individual, whoever she was somebody who was apparently trafficked. That may very well be true, but then because Jeffrey Epstein said it in an email, it doesn't make it so. I'm not absolutely clear when Epstein sent this email, but it does seem to have been written sometime after Epstein and Trump fell out. And I can't help but think that by this point, Epstein, well, would not have had very kind feelings towards Donald Trump. And he's hardly the person one would want to trust. The other thing I would say is that it is very interesting how long after his conviction, in I think it was 2008, 2009, all sorts of very interesting people continue to remain in touch with him. In Britain, we've had two scandals, one involving a prominent politician, Peter Mandelson, the other involving the King's brother, formerly Prince Andrew, who basically have seen the collapse of their reputations because it turned out, well, one of the reasons, there were several reasons, but one of the reasons was because it turned out that they remained in friendly contact with Epstein after his conviction. Well, it seems that an awful lot of other people did also. And I am making no allegation at all here of any wrongdoing and misconduct. But I was struck to read in Politico of an exchange of emails between Jeffrey Epstein and Larry Summers about Trump's behaviour at the Helsinki summit meeting between himself and Putin, which from memory took place either in 2017 or 2018. So Epstein was corresponding with people like that at that time, and people like that were corresponding with him. It still amazes me what a reach in terms of people this really very strange man appears to have had. And, well, Politico made a lot of play about Epstein's contacts with the Russians. These contacts appear to have extended to a single meeting with the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Chilkin, and he seems to have tried to get some kind of discussion with the Russians, with Lavrov, about Trump as well. But my impression from the emails is that the Russians kept Epstein at arm's bay. Perhaps they were wondering what sort of a person he was and whether it was a trap of some kind. Who knows? Anyway, all of this, but it's, I suppose, the drip feed of things about the president, about Donald Trump himself, that is attracting attention. Now, all I'm going to say is this. In our live stream with him on the Duran, Robert Barnes, the US attorney, said that the turning point in Trump's administration happened in May when Trump reversed his public promise to publish the entirety of the Epstein files. And I agree with that completely. And I think it's done and continues to do Trump enormous damage. And all I get to say about it is this. I don't know what information there is in these emails and in all of these papers. But Trump himself continues to insist that he did no wrong. Ghislaine Maxwell says that also, not that she's perhaps the most reliable source. And, well, apparently, Virginia Giuffre never made any allegations against Trump either. Just saying. All I will say is this. If it really is the case that there was absolutely no misconduct or bad conduct on the part of Trump, the right decision, obviously, was to publish all of the material and say, look, yes, I did know Epstein. Yes, I was at times on friendly terms with him. Yes, I did accept his hospitality in ways that I now very, very much regret. But I did nothing wrong, nothing actually wrong. And whatever you see written about me in these papers, you need to keep that in mind. You will not find anything that seriously damages me and implicates me there. Well, Trump didn't do that. And now what's going to happen? I'm sure that this is going to happen, is that over the next weeks and months, and who knows, maybe even years, we'll get drips and drabs, dribbles of information coming out into the open. And I predict that in that kind of way, information which could have been perhaps explained away or even justified will do Trump no end of harm, and he will find that by holding back on disclosure, the disclosure he's promised, he will have done himself no good at all. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop. Last but not least, please remember, if you like this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.